Morning. It's March 20th, 2023. It is springtime in Park City, which you can tell by the fact that it's snowing. Welcome to Mountain Money. This is Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Doug Wells. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, and it is snowing today, but the weekend felt like it might have been May.
It did, but if you look at the forecast, we're going to get snow every day. And while you're watching the snowfall or heading out for the slopes, we got a great show this morning. We're going to start our day by speaking with former United States Senator Phil Gramm. He's going to join us to discuss his book, The Myth of American Inequality, How Government Biases the Policy Debate.
And our next guest is going to be Jason Greenberg, chef and owner of Nosh, and the new restaurant, Stacked, is going to join us in studio this morning. And then Mountain Money is going to end the hour by talking with small business owner Steve Stanton, owner of 30 Minute Tire. All this and more on Mountain Money. Please stay tuned.
We live in a world where there appears to be a common belief about the challenge of income inequality. The Economist magazine in 2020 summed up the contemporary public assessment as follows, quote, "It is a truth universally acknowledged that income inequality in the rich world is high and rising," end quote. Indeed, government statistics show a discouraging divergence between incomes of different categories of households and a disappointing stubbornness in the percentage of Americans living in poverty, notwithstanding years of government efforts aimed at eradicating it. But do these statistics paint an accurate picture of what is really going on in this country? Are there systematic biases in the way we measure economic data that distort the results in a substantial way and undermine efforts to develop good policy? Former Senator Phil Gramm argues that good policy choices are dependent, in the first instance, on getting your facts straight. He is the co-author of a fascinating new book, The Myth of American Inequality, that takes a very deep dive into how government calculates economic data. We are lucky to be joined by the senator today. That book is factually dense, and I'm kind of hoping the senator will put on his professor hat and help us understand why, in his view, the reported data distorts reality. Good morning, Senator Gramm. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Roger. What an excellent summary of what the book is about.
Well, we're lucky to have you joining us, and I'm lucky to have Roger as one of my co-hosts. You know, as I look at the front flap of the book, it says, quote, "Everything you know about income inequality, poverty, and other measures of economic well-being in America is wrong." So let's start off, as Roger said, there's a ton of information in the book. Senator, could you share with us the main point that you want our listeners to take away, just to kind of frame today, this morning's discussion?
Well, the main point is that there is a number, household income, that is calculated and reported by the Census Bureau that is the foundation of all our measures of well-being, poverty, and inequality. And in 1947, when they started calculating household income, very few payments were not made in cash or cash equivalent. So they made a simplifying assumption that they would count only cash and cash equivalent payments. But by 1967, when the war on poverty came, almost all of our poverty programs were not paid in cash, but they were paid in kind. And let me just give you an example. And let me sum it up and then give you the example. So as a result, over the years, we have reached the point where the Census Bureau is not counting two-thirds of all transfer payments as income to people who got the transfers, and it's not counting taxes as income loss to people who paid the taxes. For example, it doesn't count food stamps, where you get a debit card from the government, you go to the grocery store, you buy groceries. It doesn't count that. It doesn't count Medicaid, where the government pays your medical bills. It doesn't count rent subsidies, where the government pays your rent. In total, the Census Bureau, in calculating household income, does not count over 100 federal programs and counts very few state and local programs, so that whereas the Census Bureau says the top 20% of income earners have 16.7 times as much income as the bottom 20%. When you count all the transfer payments as income to people that got the transfer, and when you take taxes as income loss, the people who paid the taxes, the actual ratio using government data is only 4-1, not 16-1. Now, you can say that 4-1 is too much. That's debatable. But it's a very, very different debate than 16.7-1. And in poverty, the poverty rate is about 11.5% by the conventional measure, which doesn't count transfer payments, or two-thirds of them. When you count all transfer payments as income, and you count taxes as income lost, the poverty rate is actually between 2-3%. And finally, whereas we've all heard this, Senator Sanders says, growth in income inequality is obscene and unsustainable. We show that if you count all transfer payments and taxes, that income inequality is actually lower today than it was in 1947. So that we're having this big debate about whether to junk American capitalism because of growing income inequality, when income inequality is actually slightly lower today than it was over 70 years ago. The census says it's up by 22%. We show using government data, accounting transfer payments and taxes, it's actually down by about 3%.
Senator, why do you think that the measures, I mean, you make an interesting case, right? Because obviously, if you're going to talk about relative income, you have to take into account, it makes sense to take into account everything that's in that bucket. So why do you think the government statistics have stayed the way they are? Why hasn't there been an effort to try to incorporate some of the things you're talking about, transfer payments and taxes?
Well, first of all, when the Census Bureau started in 1947, the way they were measuring income was reasonable. It was a good approximation, probably about 95% accurate. But over the years, as transfer payments were made in kind, it never added the transfer payments where government paid bills directly. And it ultimately calculated the data, reported the data. All of the data we use in the book is from the federal government. But it never changed the way it reported income. And it never took taxes into account, even though it used its data to calculate income inequality. And so is comparing income not counting two-thirds of all transfer payments as income and with the income of high-income individuals without taking out the fact that they're paying 35% of their income in taxes. Now, why did they do that? Why at each of the steps along the way did they make that decision? We try in the book not to get into people's motives. Mm-hmm. The point we're making is that we need to get our facts straight.
Well,
and there's plenty of room here for debate.
Well, if we can, excuse me, Senator. I want to circle back to something you said earlier, which was, you know, fascinating, and it's an important point that you make in your book, that the income inequality, the way you measure it, is 1 to 4 versus 1 to 16. That is a big difference. And as you say, you know, folks can debate about, you know, whether 1 in 4 is too high, or, you know, they have their thoughts on it. One of the things that I think is important is, what is the quality of life for people that are living in poverty? And in chapter 6 of your book, you have a chapter that you, measures of well-being. Can you share with our audience some of that data and what it says about the quality of life for people that are poor now versus decades ago?
Well, the data is pretty convincing when you look at the consumption patterns of people that are counted by the government as being poor, that there has been a dramatic increase in the standard of living. People forget in 1965, when the war on poverty started, about half of all poverty households did not have complete indoor plumbing. Today, 42% of all poor people in America own their own home. And the home, on average, has three bedrooms, one and a half baths, and a carport or a patio. 80% of the housing is air-conditioned. Only 20% of housing in general was air-conditioned in 1965. So, and the University of Chicago, an economist named Bruce Meyer, has done extensive studies where he's posed the question, how is it that when you measure what people are consuming, that only about 3% of people today are poor as compared to 1980, and yet the poverty rate when he did the study was 14.5%? Well, we answer that question by saying the reason is that government is not counting two-thirds of the transfer payments as income. And in fact, it's very telling that when you take Bruce Meyer's finding on consumption and compare it to our finding when you correct the income figure, we come up with basically the same number, even though we're coming at it from very, very different directions.
As part of the well-being discussion, Senator, you focus on the different measures of inflation and why some of the measures of inflation sort of don't take into account real-world behavior. Can you sort of explain what that does?
Yeah, it's a little complicated, but here's the deal. We don't have one cost of living that government calculates that's used to adjust for inflation so we can look at how we're doing over time. We have five. Okay? We have one that's used to adjust the tax brackets in the tax code. It is the most accurate inflation measure that we currently calculate because when relative prices change, people change consumption patterns. New products come in and people buy different things. And so this price index adjusts the so-called market basket for what people are actually buying, not what they bought in the past. And it is far more accurate than any other of our current measures. It also consistently shows a slightly lower inflation rate. Now, in 1 year, it doesn't make much difference. But over any long period of time, 10, 20, 50 years, it makes a huge difference. And so what we show here is that if you take into account what people actually consume, if you take into account the dramatic improvement in products, that actually prices over the last 50 years have risen far less than the consumer price index that's used to adjust the poverty rate and to adjust our measures of income well-being. And let me just give you a perfect example. The smartphone, when the phone came into existence, it didn't come into the consumer price index for almost 15 years. By the time it came into the consumer price index, the price had fallen dramatically. It was never captured in CPI. The battery life had risen dramatically. And the network, of course, was a huge amount greater. Nowhere in the consumer price index is there an adjustment made for the fact that on your iPhone, You've got information. You've got information available more than in the local library.
More than the whole world, actually. Equal to the whole world. Yeah. It's really amazing.
None of that is shown. And also, we show that the medical price index is still calculated based on how many days you're in the hospital, how many doctor's visits, rather than looking at what actually is happening to your health. And you look at all of these miracle cures that have changed the way we treated things. None of that is accurately portrayed in the medical price index.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Senator. And I want to remind our listeners that this is not a political show. You've heard us talk on this show in the past about income inequality, and we think having a broad discussion on income inequality is important. And part of that broad discussion, Senator, is what economists call the Gini coefficient. I just recently was able to start traveling outside of the United States for the first time. And I came across the Gini coefficient when I was trying to understand cultures and what's different in different countries versus the United States and the issue of income inequality. And the Gini coefficient helps us explore that across different countries. And I don't know, it probably helps us track that within the United States. How has some of the data that you share in your book, how does that impact the Gini coefficient?
Well, it dramatically reduces the growth in income inequality. And in fact, over the last 70 or 50 years, either one, there's actually been a very slight decline in income inequality in America when you count all transfer payments and taxes. It's not reflected in the data that is put out by the OECD because the Census Bureau doesn't submit the data. And if you submitted the data in the form that the OECD asked for it, which other nations generally do, we would not rank as the most unequal nation in terms of income inequality, but we would rank right in the middle of the top seven. And there's one other point that I want to make on that, and that is that doesn't mean that you can't just look at the fact that more people are classified as poor in America and say we're therefore worse off than France. People that are classified as poor in America basically have close to a middle income living standard in countries like France, Germany, and Britain. We forget that if you applied our standards to those countries, that they would have a much higher poverty rate than we do.
Senator, the input into overall inequality that you do identify as growing the most is what we would label as earned income inequality, and you focus on that in Chapter 5. What are the major causes that you identified for the growth in differentiation in earned income?
Well, two big ones. One is, do you work? And that's vitally important because as government transfer payments to the bottom 20% of earners has grown over the last 50 years from $9,700 per average household to $45,400 per average household, the percentage of prime work age adults that are actually working has fallen from 68% to 36%. And obviously the people that stopped working got off the economic escalator and they've not benefited by the growth in America that has occurred over the last 50 years. They have benefited by growth in government payments, but it basically stunts their growth in income at that point. So the first factor is, do you work or don't you work? The second factor is the quantity and quality of education. hardly a surprise for most people that have broken into the middle class and have broken into higher income levels. They did it by education. Most of your listeners, either they or their parents, probably broke out, so to speak, through education. They got good education and they got lots of it.
Yeah,
so we take a long look at that whole thing as to what the differences are. So everybody that works has progressed, but the sharper your tools are, as my mother would have said, education, the more you benefited. The value of a college degree remarkably continues to rise, even though you've got a proliferation of colleges. It still is increasingly valuable.
Yeah, completely agree, Senator. I come from a family where neither of my parents ever made more than three times minimum wage their whole life. And thanks to a military scholarship, I was able to get educated, and it's made a huge difference in my life. So completely agree with you on that. And if we have time, I want to come back to your thoughts on colleges. But I want to make sure we use our time to really ask you some key questions that are super important. We've been speaking about your book, but I opened the interview talking about a quote on the front cover. This might be my last question, and so for my last question, I want to talk to you about something that's on the back cover, which talks about your background, Senator, as 18 years as a U.S. Senator. You were the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, and you also were the vice chairman of UBS Investment Bank. All of that, the banking sector in UBS is very timely and in the news today. Obviously, UBS is in the news about their takeover of Credit Suisse and the problems Credit Suisse has had over the last couple weeks. I'd love for you to share your thoughts with the listener on the banking crisis and kind of your take. How worried should we be?
Well, I think, first of all, let me talk about Silicon Valley Bank, where it started. Silicon Valley Bank was almost not a bank. Some 93-94% of its deposits were more than $250,000 and therefore weren't totally insured. It was a repository where people held very large cash balances. Silicon Valley paid 0.6% more than market to induce people to hold balances in the bank. And it bought government bonds of a long duration. And so what happened when interest rates went up, those bonds had a fixed interest rate. And what the bank had to pay for deposits went up in price, but what it was getting on its government bonds didn't change, and as a result, they became insolvent. And it should have been obvious to a blind man that this was happening when you looked at the makeup of the bank. Why the regulators missed regulatory policy 101, that when a bank is paying more for deposits than other banks, when it is holding larger deposits than other banks on average, and when it's got a problem in holding long-term securities that are declining in value as interest rates rise, it should have triggered an action months ago by the regulators. It didn't, and the bank is insolvent. And so the federal government steps in. What happened to Credit Suisse was, Credit Suisse has had problems for a very long time. And so when Silicon Valley Bank had its problem, it created waves in the financial system, and those waves took under Credit Suisse. Fortunately, UBS was there and in an agreement with a central bank in Switzerland, has worked out a deal to take over Credit Suisse. and basically guarantee its deposits. Should we be worried? Let me just put it this way. I think our banking system is basically sound. It is certainly far different and stronger than it was in 2008, where half of all the mortgages held by banks were subprime. And when prices of real estate started stopped going up, the value of those mortgages collapsed. But it is never a good idea to hold more money in a bank than is insured. It's easy to get around it by having multiple accounts. You can buy short-term treasury bills. So my answer to your question is, I think the financial system is sound, but nevertheless, it's not good policy, either for you or for the country, for you to have vast amounts of cash in a bank account.
Senator, if you have time for one more question, I've got one more.
No, sure, I've got plenty.
Okay. Senator, I want to finish by what I thought was a really interesting part of the book, which is we hear repeatedly that the American dream is dead and that parents today don't expect their children to end up as well off as they are. You argue that's wrong. Can you share with the audience a little bit about that?
Yeah, 93% of all children who grow up in bottom 20 percentile families in income, the bottom 20% of income-earning families, make more as adults than their parents. And 63% of them not only make more than their parents, but move into a higher quintile of earnings. And that's compared to the people in the era in which they're living. If you compare it to the era their parents lived and the era where they were children, 64% of Americans today have income levels that in 50 years ago would have put them in the top 20% of income earners. You should go back and look at what the world was like 50 years ago. Look at the house you grew up in. Maybe I'm old, so 50 years is right for me, probably wrong for you. But in any case, people just forget the incredible progress that has been made. So there are poor people, okay? There are about 2 to 3% of people that because of mental illness or drug abuse or some other problem are not taking advantage of the government programs. They've fallen through the cracks. And no matter what we do to food stamps or refundable tax credits, we're not reaching those people. The only way to reach them is to figure out what their problem is and try to help them. So I'm not saying they're not poor people. There are poor people. But they're not poor because we're not providing enough in the way of resources. We long ago provided more resources than necessary to eliminate statistical poverty in America.
We've been talking with Senator Phil Graham about his book, The Myth of American Inequality, How Government Biases Policy Debate. Senator, thanks so much for joining us, and I thank my friend Kent Sullivan for putting us in touch with you.
Listen, thank you. And you can buy the book through Amazon or any big bookstore, and I think it's worth a read because the message of it is this is a better country than is being portrayed by government statistics. The American dream is alive and well, and it works for you if you work.
Thank you, Senator. We'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Mound Money. The Park City Plaza on Bonanza Drive is a great place to find a bite to eat. Jason Greenberg, chef and owner of Nosh, and the new restaurant Stacked, both are located in the plaza. And we've got Jason and his wife, Katie Babcock, in the studio with us. Jason, you joined us in the studio last to talk about Nosh. Really just before the world went crazy in February of 2020.
And we're very happy to have you here in the studio with us again. Of course, not much has changed since then. I say in jest, obviously. So tell us about your new restaurant.
So Stacked Sandwich Co., we decided to open up a sandwich shop after the success and the continued success of Nosh. It is a wonderful, great all-American style sandwich shop. Everything from banh mi sandwiches to house-made pastrami and roast beef. We're going to be expanding our menu as the seasons go on. And we're just trying to create a wonderful place for the community to come and grab a light bite to eat or a sandwich at any time.
And are you going to be open for lunch and dinner?
So we're open right now, currently Tuesday through Saturday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. And those hours might adjust as we get busier, as the seasons change, things like that.
And what's the character of the place? I mean, obviously, when you start with a restaurant called Nosh, there's a question I would have as to whether you're trying to emulate a deli kind of atmosphere. Tell us a little bit about what side dishes you offer and the sort of feel of the place when I walk in.
So I was actually a part owner of Main Street Deli when it was on Main Street. And so we unfortunately closed when COVID happened. But we love sandwiches and we love the idea of bringing an affordable, sort of approachable breakfast and lunch to Park City. There are a couple places doing it, but not a lot. And so when Bonnie and Clyde's unfortunately went out, it was just the most convenient thing to be super close. And what we're trying to do is just offer a casual sort of atmosphere where you can walk in and either get a sandwich to go. We have a little lounge area where you can sit and hang out. And we're expanding our menu. So right now we're doing breakfast and lunch. We're doing everything we can do in-house. So all of our sandwiches come with house-made chips, but we do frequently changing deli sides, pasta salads, potato salads, kind of things that, you know, like comfort food type things. We're doing soups in-house. And that will, you know, continue going, and everything's changing as you know, the season goes on. The sandwiches will change up a little bit, but everything we can do in-house, we are doing. And we really just want to be, you know, the restaurant that you can go into. We're sort of an open kitchen, so it's nice to get to know the locals, which we've had a great time doing at Nosh, and we'd like to continue that at Stacked.
Well, I think I shared with you in the green room before we went live that I've been to Nosh's. I haven't been to Stacked yet. My notes here say that it's a unique New York-esque deli sandwich. I've been to New York a couple times, so that conjures up some thoughts in my mind as to what that is. As a vegan, I have to ask, or I'm guessing there's no vegan options, but if there are, let the audience know.
So I think there is something to be said about the New York sandwich. I don't know that you really have a New York sandwich. I think that sandwiches are just part of New York culture. You go to New York and there's a deli on every corner, and it's something that everybody eats. You get a slice of pizza or a food from the halal truck, or you go to a deli. So I think that was something that we felt like was missing here. And just so you know, there are quite a few vegan options. So we do things, we do tofu, we do mushrooms. So you can do a mushroom Philly, which is fantastic. That would be vegetarian, not vegan, but we have a vegan wrap. And we have a lot of, you can switch out proteins for a lot of things. So we probably have 5 or 6 vegan options that are just
I'm
on
curious,
the menu.
That's very progressive to have vegan options at a sandwich shop. There's not many that do. I know a lot, I'm not gluten-free, but I know a lot of people are gluten-free. Do you have options for them as well?
Yes, we do. So we have gluten-free bread, and you also have the option to put any of our sandwiches on a salad if you would prefer to do that. So yes, there are options for that both ways.
I can't resist telling you that when you talk about the unfortunate way that Bonnie and Clyde went out, I have visions of Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway in a field of blood. But let me ask this question. You talk about your breakfast. Can you share with us a little bit about breakfast options?
Yeah. Currently, we have a very limited menu on breakfast, but we do have an all-day breakfast menu where we can get a breakfast wrap. You can get a bagel with cream cheese or a bagel with eggs and cheese. We do have a breakfast sandwich, granola, things like that. And as the year goes on, we will add to that. We want to become a breakfast place. We have a full cafe area. We're a full espresso bar. So we're offering any kind of coffee concoction you can think of.
And house-made pastries.
And house-made pastries. In addition to that, we will be adding things as we see fit and what the community is looking for. You know, we want feedback. If you're looking for something specific, we'll make it.
So I hope I get a chance to ask another question, but this might be my last question. So I've got to ask, my parents work together in their business, and you guys are husband and wife, and we all have memories of, like, very common sayings that our parents would say. And for my mother, the one that's burnt into my head is, they work together, and at home, my mom would try really hard not to talk about work. So the most common phrase that I heard as a child from my mother is, no work, Willie, no work, Willie. His name was Willis, but she called him Willie. Talk to us about some of the joys and some of the challenges of being a married couple in a small business together.
It's not for everyone. We've made it work. We've been together working in restaurants side by side, I don't know, 10 plus years. So you kind of get used to the 12 years. So the pluses and minuses of what each can do. Katie is excellent at communication and catering and ideas and baking. I'm more on the business side.
Keep going on the list of what Katie's good for.
Katie's good. Yeah. So, okay, let's see what else. She's really taken charge of our whole catering department. Really getting what the guest wants. I am there more on an administrative level on some respects. And it's just about finding that balance. Every relationship, whether you're married or not, has challenges. Ours, we take home with us.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that doesn't work for most people. We've made it work. We met in kitchens. So I think we both knew what we were getting into when we got into it. And, luckily we work with friends and they see some things that they probably shouldn't. And then they see some things that, you know, I mean, it's we're literally family. His mother works there. So mother-in-law, our two best friends or our three best friends work for us. So we're truly a family. So, you know, there's better times and good times, but we have way more good times than bad times.
And now I'm getting images of the bear. But anyway, let me ask this question. In a time when a lunch at Subway cost probably $14, right? You mentioned earlier before that you were trying to seek an affordable place. What does that mean? And give us a range of the kind of pricing we'd see.
So we actually are just adding to our menu. Like we said, where things are constantly changing. So we do have a kids menu that we try to keep below. I mean, that's $10. We're doing a high school menu. So the high school kids can come in and we're trying to keep that below 12. And that way you sort of draw the kids in and we're, you know, it's a limited menu, but I think the most expensive thing on the menu is $18. But our sandwiches are starting at, I think, $10, and that's with a side. And part of our goal is to really be, you know, there are a lot of choices in Park City. A lot of them are not super affordable. And we want to fall in that sort of in between fast food and high end. We want you to come in, have a comfortable place to eat, spend some time, get delicious food, have something that is made in house as much as possible. And you know, maybe you can afford to come back more than once a month.
So there's a lot of restaurants located in the plaza, and we're a business show, so I want to ask a business question. Is it helpful to have that synergy of other restaurants in the plaza, or do you think it makes it a super competitive space to do business?
You know, I think that's one of the questions we get asked the most, because there are, I think, six of us. And I think the best way to explain it is it's a complete non-compete. So there's a sandwich shop, there's a Mexican place, there's a Middle Eastern place, there's a Colombian burger place, there's a pho place, there's a smoothie place, and there's Sammy's. So we're all different. And what we found is that, like, when Chubasco runs out of cilantro, they come to us. When Rio run out of tomatoes, we go to them. When Burgers and Barley needs lemon juice, they come to us. So everyone is sharing. And I think because we're all so different, it's actually a draw to people because there are so many choices there. And I don't think there's any animosity. I mean, we're really good friends with Burgers and Barley. And the same with the, I think, the manager at Chubasco. We see her all the time. And I think because we're so different, it's actually a good thing for us.
I'm glad to hear that because, you know, I moved to Park City 20 years ago, and one of the things that I just fell in love with is Park City is very much a community. Yeah. I grew up outside of Cleveland, Ohio, and I never knew that a town could have, like, a brand and an identity that everybody buys into. And it makes this place super special. So I'm glad to hear that happens on a micro basis as well.
Well, maybe our last question. For locals in particular, sometimes speed is important. Are you doing anything with respect to advance ordering, website delivery? Tell us what things either you're doing now or things that you're thinking about.
Well, with Nosh, it's definitely been about speed. As far as Stacked goes, it's a sandwich. Mm-hmm. We are busy, and we're still trying to figure it out. So we're trying to get everything out within 15 minutes. We're not doing online orders yet, but we want to. It's just about naturally getting to that point. We don't want to overwhelm ourselves or the customers, so we're going to get there. We're just not there yet.
And are you thinking about contracting with any of the delivery services as well?
Eventually, we might. We have had some difficulties in the past, but we're hoping that that has changed. As the town gets busier, we found that there are more delivery options, Uber Eats and
We had a bad experience with DoorDash. We did use them at Nosh for a while, but it's something that we'd be willing to look into again. It really just depends on the service and how it follows through once the food leaves our hands, because we want the food to show up at the customer's house or wherever they are the way we want it.
Yeah, because you get blamed either way. And Roger, you said last question, but we can't let Jason and Katie go without telling our visitors in town that may not know where the plaza is, how people can go visit your restaurants. Where are you located? How would you tell a visitor where you're located?
Yeah, we are located at 1890 Bonanza Drive in that shopping center, Park City Plaza. We're across from Alberto's. We're in Prospector area. You can find us online through our website, stackedpc.com or noshpc.com. Try to keep it very simple that way. And you can find us on your favorite, I guess, web browser, Google, you know?
Mostly Google.
Mostly Google.
All right. We've been talking with Jason Greenberg and Katie Babcock about Stacked and Nosh, located at the Bonanza Plaza. I know I'm going to try to get one of those sandwiches soon.
I'm in for a vegan sandwich sometime soon.
I got you.
We'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Seasonal tire changes are just one of the joys of living along the Wasatch back. Steve and Kathy Stanton are the owners of 30 Minute Tire. They join us this morning to talk about how this new business can help make this biannual task a little more tolerable. Thank you both for joining us. We've got like 7 minutes to talk about 30-minute tires. So quickly, it's a challenge we all have. I hate taking the time to get my tires changed, but yet I need good quality snow tires, as does everybody here. So tell us about your business.
You know, we were out of the country for last winter, so we'd come back to town and I called the local tire shops to get our snow tires taken off of the Jeep, and realized it was going to take a month and a half to get an appointment. So
I drive to Salt Lake City for that reason.
Yeah, exactly, like many people, right? So I started looking at that as an opportunity and sort of realized with 65,000 registered vehicles here in Summit County that there's obviously a shortage of capacity. So we took a look at how we would try to influence that.
Roger and I are both scratching our heads about 65,000 registered vehicles here.
65,000 vehicles in Summit County.
Well, we have a lot of cars, unfortunately, right? I was guilty of this myself.
Small trucks, SUVs, and passenger.
So is your business, tell us a little bit about what the scope of your business is. Obviously, seasonal tire changing is a major part of it. What else, is that all you're really trying to do?
That's all we're going to do. We're going to do 30-minute tire changes. We're not going to do alignments or oil changes or anything else. And we're going to store tires as well so people don't have to haul them around back and forth.
So is this a very clever way to find a job where you really only have to work for a few months, twice a year?
Pretty much, yeah.
And in the shoulder season of all things. This is brilliant. Do you guys need a business partner? No, I'm just kidding. So walk us through the basics. So you offer tire storage, which is a challenge for all of us, right? And give us an idea of cost. What does it cost to do the tire change, and what does it cost to store the tires?
Yeah, the 30-minute tire change is $160, and we'll charge $200 per season to store your tires.
And are you, obviously you have a physical location. Where do people bring their vehicles into the physical location?
They do. They'll bring them in, and we have a lovely little waiting room there that's going to be super cool, and they can hit golf balls while they're at it if they want to.
You got
to work on their golf game, right? And we'll get them out in 30 minutes.
So I'm curious, before you guys started this, what were your careers beforehand?
Well, I've been in the manufacturing business for 40 years. I'm an architect by profession.
So. Yeah, but he was retired for 3 years and then decided he needed to do this.
He failed at retirement?
He failed drastically, yeah.
It looks like it. Somebody asked me what might have been the shortcomings, and I thought, well, the problem with this whole business was realizing that it... this is going to take an hour and a half to get my tires changed, so all of a sudden I had to come out of retirement. It's like, I'm not sure what brought that on.
And how many employees do you have?
We have three tire technicians on staff now. The business is growing. We'll be ready with a new building for the winter season, but right now we're going to manage just with our highly skilled and state-of-the-art equipment for the spring tire change season.
And where are you located?
We're right off of old Route 40, just past the Home Depot.
South of Home Depot, over in that commercial neighborhood that's south of Home Depot off of 40.
So we're a business show, right? And a lot of people are thinking about, you know, planning for retirement. And I love the answer that you just shared, right? A lot of people are trying to, particularly in Park City, right? This is a town where people are we're uber competitive here. And a lot of people are racing towards what they see as a finish line, which is retirement. So... yeah, you might have been in that category as well. What were your two or three big surprises when you first retired that people should know about?
Well, you know, we've stayed pretty busy. You know, I'm an architect, so I went back to architecture. So that was really as a hobby as opposed to a business, right? We've done 5 houses here in Park City, remodeled them. So that kept me pretty busy until sort of recently when I had a tire problem.
You obviously, one of the things I'm looking at the information we were given, the way in which you get the 30 minutes is you have to make an appointment. And so tell us a little bit about that process and how many days a week are you going to be open and how backed up are you now? Give us some perspective of where things are.
We're not backed up right now, actually. We've got a pretty open schedule. I anticipate that by mid-April, we're going to really start cranking. And we're at that point right now, people can actually come in and we'll be happy to take care of them. But come mid-April, it's going to have to be appointment based only. We won't be able to have drop-ins. But it's very easy. You just go to 30minutetire.com and you schedule your appointment. We have 30-minute increments. So
you guys got 30minutetire.com. That's a great URL.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah. Good. Yeah, that's great. You know, if the snow doesn't let up anytime soon,
maybe
this week, yeah, you might be your plan of having off 8 months out of the year might backfire on you.
Yeah, we had some guy call this morning. As a matter of fact, the new thing is potholes. He said he just ran over a pothole and destroyed his winter tire, so he needs to change his tires much sooner than he anticipated in this case.
So what was your first season? Was it the last late fall going into the winter?
Yeah, we didn't get started really until February. So we've got our building underway, which we, like I said, we'll have up and running for winter season. But for now, we've done a couple of dozen customers storing, and you know, people wanted to get them out of their attics and out of their garages and under their decks. They called us up just to store tires to get ready for next season.
How many days a week are you going to be open, and what are the hours going to be?
We're going to be open 7 days a week, 10 hours a day when we get going. Just because we need to meet the demand, I think.
Right now, it's just 8 to 4. Monday through Friday. But when we start getting appointments, we'll definitely be 7 days a week, 10 hours a day.
And then I'm guessing the location will not be open 12 months out of the year. Is that correct?
We're trying to figure out what else to do for the, you know, if you've got any ideas, we'd love to hear them, because it will be, pretty available when we're not changing tires.
We talked about washing dogs, because that's a big market here too as well. There's a shortage, right? Just teasing. We can practice our golf.
You could do that.
Okay, so again, the website is 30minutetire.com, and you're located by the home, behind the Home Depot, off of Old Route on Old Route 40.
Yeah, on Forestdale Drive.
And so where's the new building going to be when you get around to doing that?
Same place. It's in the same complex, but it's a building that's right across the driveway from us.
Okay, again, when you're talking about we're talking about 7 days a week. How many are you going to be able to do that with three tire technicians?
No, we'll have more.
Okay,
we'll be hiring more people.
Yeah. Exactly.
All right. Well, anything else you want our audience to hear before we go?
No.
No, I think
us?
We're.
No, sorry. No, thank you so much.
Oh, they hear from me every week. They hear plenty from me. All right. Well, thank you guys for joining. And Mound Money will be back in a moment to wrap up. Please stay tuned.